This is Free Speech Radio News on June 18, 2003. From WBAI in New York City, I'm Amma Bouadi. Indian businesses lobby the Indian government to help them get a share of business contracts in Iraq. In France, demonstrators protest to demand the release of a leader of the People's Mujahideen, and the US Senate debates Medicare. But first, these headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. U.S. troops opened fire today on a demonstration in Baghdad, killing one former Iraqi soldier and injuring another. The former soldiers were protesting in demand of payment of salaries unpaid since the top U.S. civil administrator in Iraq, Paul Bremer, officially dissolved the Iraqi army on May 23rd. Israel today threatened retaliation for a Palestinian ambush that killed an Israeli girl and wounded her sister just minutes after the Palestinian prime minister finished meeting with leaders of militant groups in a failed effort to persuade them to stop attacks. Mohammed Galyini reports from Gaza.
Palestinian gunmen killed a 7-year-old Israeli girl last night near the West Bank city of Qalqilia. The girl died in a shooting ambush against her car on a highway near the wall built to separate the West Bank from Israel. The fact that the gunmen could breach the security of the wall tells of one of the unpublicized purposes of the wall, to expropriate large swathes of land from the West Bank. The Israeli army then sent tanks, helicopter gunships and bulldozers into Qalqilia to search for the gunmen. They arrested one Palestinian. According to the Palestinian news agency, it is not yet clear whether he was involved in the attack. The Palestinian Prime Minister Abbas failed yesterday to convince a committee of 13 Palestinian factions to agree to a truce with Israel. The factions showed a united front, saying that they could not agree to a truce without clear guarantees to preserve the rights of Palestinians. They also stated they would not give up the right of resistance inside the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. Prime Minister Abbas is holding another round of truce talks with Islamic Jihad and Hamas in Gaza today. The results of those talks are not yet clear. This is Mohammed Galayini for Free Speech Radio News in Gaza.
Vietnam has sentenced a writer to 13 years in prison on charges of espionage. Duali Saikautau reports that one of the documents used against the author was a translation of an essay on democracy from the U.S. Embassy in Hanoi.
Dr. Pham Hong Son was already held in custody for more than a year before his trial actually took place. The Hanoi People's Court found the 35-year-old man guilty of spying today, accusing Son of passing information to anti-government groups and using the internet to spread criticism of Vietnam. In reaction to the sentencing, Amnesty International says Vietnamese authorities are showing blatant disregard for freedom of expression and fundamental human rights. Other groups, including the Committee to Protect Journalists, have criticized Vietnam's government for its ongoing campaign to criminalize writers who use the internet to publish news or opinions. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Duahli Saikautau in Bangkok.
A Senate committee is scheduled to vote tomorrow on legislation that could undo part of the recent FCC ruling to relax media ownership regulations. Gareth Schweitzer reports from Washington.
The bipartisan bill called the Preservation of Localism, Program Diversity, and Competition in Television Broadcast Service Act would use congressional legislation to overturn the FCC's recent ruling. The bill would amend the Communications Act of 1934 and the Telecommunications Act of 1996 to restore the previous national media ownership cap to 35% audience reach for any given television network. The proposed law would apply to all media ownership groups and appears to have bipartisan support. Commerce Committee Chairman John McCain has agreed to bring the legislation to a vote in committee, even though he supports the FCC's decision to deregulate. A similar bill exists in the House of Representatives, also with support from both parties. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
Jordan's main Islamist politicians regained a major foothold in parliament, and they promised vocal opposition to the pro-Western government for the first time in 6 years. Islamist officials said they will call for a more critical approach to the United States and Israel and make officials more accountable to popular wishes. Ula Al-Ferawati reports from Amman on the election results.
The final results of Jordan's parliamentary elections showed Wednesday that Jordan's King Abdullah allies won 50 of the 120 lower house seats. Muslim fundamentalists returned to the legislature as the largest opposition bloc as they won 18 of the seats. Jordan's strongest political party, the Islamic Action Front, accused the government of fraud and said the results were not accurate. The government categorically denied the allegations. The lower house is expected to convene early in August. In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati for Free Speech Radio News.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
In Paris, three people set themselves on fire today in a day-long protest against the roundups of Iranian exiles allegedly affiliated with the People's Mujahideen. According to Associated Press reports, Washington and Tehran have welcomed the raids, which took place on Paris on Tuesday and saw more than 150 people arrested. The majority of those arrested have now been freed, but demonstrators are asking for the release of the group's figurehead, Mariam Rajavi. Nick Champeau reports from Paris.
About 50 Mujahideen sympathizers gathered in front of one branch of the French secret services in Paris's 15th district near the Eiffel Tower. The first woman there who set herself alight, Marzieh Bakani, was a political refugee in Paris. She was taken to hospital in critical condition. Omoul Rabidi is a member of the Mujahideen Linked Group, the National Council for the Resistance of Iran. He recounts the incident.
She didn't tell anybody. She just came. We just saw her in the street and she was burning. You can see this is the marks of, you know, she burned herself right there.
On the blue car here.
Exactly. And nobody knew in advance. Nobody had any idea. And we just saw her and we stopped her. And she's severely burned now. And two of her brothers were killed by the Ayatollahs in Iran. And she's a very well-known human rights activist.
Policemen carrying fire extinguishers rounded up the 40 Iranian demonstrators after Marzieh Bakani set fire to herself. But this did not prevent two other Iranian demonstrators from setting themselves alight later on. Yesterday morning, police arrested 165 members of the People's Mujahideen in several raids conducted in suburban Paris. More than 130 have been released since, but not Mariam Rajavi. Free Mariam Rajavi, they were shouting at the demo this morning. Mariam Rajavi is the wife of Massoud Rajavi, the Mujahideen's historical chief. She is now seen as the group's figurehead. Suna Samsani is an Iranian dissident who lives in the United States.
She's the symbol of hope, symbol of freedom. She's looking for democracy. She's looking for a secular government in Iran. That's the hope of 94% of majority of people inside Iran and millions of Iranians outside of Iran. There are today a lot of French people around, a lot of people from others, you know, surrounding area also joining to be outspoken, and they're asking international community to interfere so Mrs. Rajavi would be released as soon as possible.
Tuesday's operation was part of an investigation on the financing of terrorism ordered by France's anti-terrorist judge Jean-Louis Bruguière. Police report that they have seized four suitcases with $8 million in cash and sophisticated computer equipment, but no weapons or explosive substances were found during the roundup. The People's Mujahideen are willing to overthrow the current Islamic regime of Iran. Up until now, France has not targeted this group. Under Saddam Hussein, many of the group's members had established themselves in Iraq, which allowed them to prepare attacks on Iran. Now that the U.S. has occupied Iraq, French observers believe that Tuesday's wave of arrests was aimed at preventing France from becoming the Mujahideen's new base. Washington and the European Union have listed them as a terrorist movement. Lies, says Farid Soleyani, a London-based member of the National Council of Resistance for Iran. He was arrested in Paris in yesterday's police raid and was released at dusk today.
What is strange is not my coming to Paris. What's strange is the French government's mobilization, the biggest police mobilization in 30 years against an organization which has not conducted a single act of unlawful act outside Iran for the past 25 years.
Iran's president, Mohammad Khatami, demanded this afternoon that detained members of the People's Mujahideen be extradited to Iran. Paris, Nick Champeau, Free Speech Radio News.
In Washington today, the House of Representatives looked ready to vote for a repeal on the estate tax, a tax on a small fraction of wealthy Americans that's often called the death tax by Republicans. A vote to repeal the tax in the Senate looks increasingly likely. The Senate spent the day today on the Medicare bill, specifically the proposal to add a prescription drug benefit to the federal health insurance program. And as Congress debates the cost of drug coverage to seniors, a new study finds it might make economic sense for the government to cover health care for everyone who doesn't have it. Josh Chaffin has more from the Capitol.
Democrats and Republicans in Congress and the White House are all calling for a prescription drug benefit to go along with Medicare. The bills with the best chance of passing by a July 4th goal would have patients paying an estimated $35 copay on their drugs at the pharmacy. Full insurance for drugs would only kick in after seniors have paid out as much as $3,700 of their own money. A few Democrats, like Richard Durbin of Illinois, are trying to amend the Senate bill to achieve more comprehensive coverage.
70% being paid by the federal government, no deductible, a guaranteed $35 monthly premium, and the way we'll achieve it is by reducing the cost of the drugs, as we do in the Veterans Administration today.
The Veterans Administration is often pointed to as a model for cutting drug costs, using bulk buying and tough negotiations with manufacturers. Republicans argue the sheer number of separate drugs needed to cover everyone on Medicare would make these tactics unworkable. Drug companies gave about $27 million to political campaigns in 2002, three-quarters of it to Republicans. That according to the nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics. The most controversial aspect of the Medicare bill is the proposal to let private insurance plans have a piece of the action, as the White House has requested. Some Democrats suspect that tactic is a backdoor to the eventual privatization of Medicare, and they don't trust a market-based approach to keeping drugs affordable over time. Republicans say that letting private insurers into the Medicare structure would keep the program from becoming an unfunded liability. Senate Health Committee Chair Judd Gregg.
If, for example, we simply put onto the Medicare system a $330 billion new drug benefit, which was the proposal last year, today it's $400 billion. But that $330 billion drug benefit over 10 years translates into a $4.6 trillion add-on in unfunded liability in the Medicare system, which just means that you have to raise taxes on working Americans, on our children and their children, in order to pay for.
An alliance of consumer and seniors groups said yesterday they may oppose the drug benefit proposal the Senate is working on. Several Democratic presidential candidates said the same, arguing the bill would do little for a substantial proportion of elderly Americans. Congressional debate over the Medicare bill will likely continue into late next week. In a related story, a study by the Institute of Medicine finds the U.S. would save money if the government were to start covering the estimated 41 million people currently without health insurance. The Institute, which advises the federal government on health matters, says the economy loses between $65 and $130 billion a year in what it calls health capital, the economic value of people staying healthy. Mary Sue Coleman is president of the University of Michigan and a co-chair of the committee that wrote the report.
This is the same concept that EPA uses in the FDA when they look at interventions like seatbelts or airbags or whatever. Not having those costs the nation. The concept of health capital does more than just look at lost productivity and people not being able to work. It's the notion of not being healthy, not being able to participate in the society, and particularly for children, developmental problems that really occur because, say, a child has untreated ear infections, they lose hearing, they're not able to learn. I mean, these are costs the society is bearing, whether it knows about it or not, and our report is pointing those out to the nation.
The Institute of Medicine finds that covering the uninsured would likely cost the government between $34 and $69 billion. The first payment for the invasion of Iraq cost the Treasury about $75 billion. Josh Chaffin at the Capitol for Free Speech Radio News.
The United States seems likely to convince the Indian administration to get 17,000 troops to aid what it describes as its reconstruction effort. A high-level Pentagon delegation is on a clarification mission in New Delhi at the moment, convincing Indian officials to send their troops. While the opposition parties in India have expressed their dissent over Indian troops working under U.S. Central Command, they don't seem to mind if the same invitation is extended to the Indian government by the United Nations. Confederation of Indian Industries estimates $500 billion in business over the next 8 years. From New Delhi, our correspondent Vinod Kejos files this story.
When the American officials claim that their South Asia mission is to keep peace in the continent and do not have any game plan, getting Indian troops to Iraq was one of the main assignments of Pentagon in South Asia. The flow of events is like this. First, early in May, Armitage managed to get an assurance from India to send its notorious Rashtriya Rifles. Later, India backed out. Indian Deputy Prime Minister was again told about sending troops in his last week visit in the US. And in this week, a top delegation from Pentagon is shuttling across offices in Delhi, impressing upon the Indian officials and ministers to send its troops. But the political parties, other than the ruling BJP, expressed their dissent in Indian troop working under US Central Command. Seshadrichari, the editor of the Hindu right RSS mouthpiece, organizer.
Why should India send army to Iraq to fight the rebellion and do the policing job, which is basically the job of the United States Army, the Allied Forces? So do we accept that they have failed? If they have not failed, it is their duty to carry out the job which they started.
From Indian government's point of view, the confusion over sending troops to Iraq is less to do with military cooperation with US. Rather, it is simple business and money. The highest lobby of Indian industries, called Confederation of Indian Industries, or CII, was very upset when the war began, because they had invested a lot of money in Saddam's Iraq. But now, Indian industries are told by India's External Affairs Ministry not to lag behind in working with US to get orders and share in the Iraqi reconstruction cake. Dr. Uttam Sinha is a researcher on Iraq and oil matters with India's Defence and Strategic Analysis.
Since the US is the big player now, and since there are enormous benefits in Iraq, obviously the business interest should surmount all other interest. So that's the big issue here. And obviously there are a lot of business bargains to strike in Iraq. And obviously the business factor, the business interest factor, should supersede all other factors here.
World Economic Forum meeting on Iraq is to be held in Amman on June 21st to 23rd. The Indian industries is sending its delegation led by Indian External Affairs Minister, and Confederation of Indian Industries has set up a task force to make favorable decision from Indian government and to help Indian companies who are bidding. Probably it could be this task force which apply pressure on Indian government to send troops. Again, Dr. Uttam Sinha.
Once you decide upon sending a troop, you're basically saying, well, we're helping out the Americans in, you know, stabilizing Iraq over there. And once that starts, the process starts off, obviously you find due favors with the American establishment. And obviously some of the lollipops which the Americans will give would result in these kind of oil contracts or the post-reconstruction contracts given to India.
The troop that Armitage asked from India, Rashtriya Rifles, is specially trained for counterinsurgency operations. Their success in Kashmir in acting with an iron fist must be the logic behind Armitage demanding Rashtriya Rifles and not any other Indian troops. Scholars like Kumar Sanjay Singh thinks Rashtriya Rifles is going to be an effective killing machine in the hands of US.
The choice of Rashtriya Rifles is interesting because Rashtriya Rifles has a very bad track record of human rights violation towards the minorities, be it in Kashmir, be it in Northeast. Quite clear that what America wants is that it wants a very efficient killing machine which would be absolutely ruthless and would have no sympathy with the Iraqi people to be stationed in Iraq at the beck and call of their American masters.
While the political parties were busy talking about sending troops, the US ambassador in India time and again reminded Indians about their vital business interests in energy supplies and possible favors it could grab if they have a strong military presence in Iraq. And if the government wants to send troops, asking US to get a UN invitation can silence the dissent of other political parties. US Ambassador to India, Robert Blackwell, at a press conference in Bombay last month.
In any case, the Bush administration, despite constant media speculation to the contrary, will not mediate the Kashmir issue. In this respect, there will be no American roadmaps, no American game plans, no American subsidy proposals. Differences between India and Pakistan must be resolved bilaterally between India and Pakistan.
Going through media headlines, the American interest in South Asia has hardly anything to do with a lasting peace in South Asia. It looks like U.S. is having their agenda. At this moment, their mission is getting anything more than 15,000 Indian troops to Iraq. From New Delhi, in India, I am Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
Guidelines issued yesterday by the U.S. Department of Justice are calling for a ban of racial and ethnic profiling, except in cases involving national security or border issues. The ban will affect federal agencies and about 120,000 U.S. law enforcement officers, including those from the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security. But critics of the ban say these Justice Department guidelines give the government a green light to profile Arab and South Asian immigrants. Max Pringle reports.
The new guidelines represent the first across-the-board policy on racial profiling and will govern the conduct of 70 law enforcement agencies. For example, under the new rules, federal law enforcement agents cannot target specific neighborhoods based on their ethnic profile. But in counter-terror investigations or national security operations, agents will still be able to use ethnic and racial data to identify suspects. The Immigration and Naturalization Service will still require men from certain Arab and Middle Eastern nations to register. During the 2000 presidential campaign, then-candidate Bush addressed concerns from mainly black and Hispanic groups about disproportionate numbers of traffic stops and other law enforcement procedures in their communities. Bush called racial profiling wrong and promised to end it. Civil libertarians say the government is playing on Americans' fears. Hussein Ibish is with the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee.
The government is finding it useful to make the distinction between racial profiling in regular law enforcement cases involving traditional American minorities and racial profiling when it comes to counterterrorism and national security measures, the one being not okay, the other being okay. It's the same kind of distinction the government has tried to play on between eroding and really going after the civil liberties of immigrant groups, particularly Arabs and Muslims, with a vengeance, while sort of only accumulating powers against citizens and being very reticent against using them.
Justice Department officials were unavailable for comment, and White House officials did not return Free Speech Radio News' calls by airtime. But Bush administration officials say that some ethnic profiling is necessary to avert possible catastrophes like the September 11th attacks. They say if the government gets warning that persons from a certain ethnic group are planning an attack, it makes sense to scrutinize more closely individuals matching that profile. King Downing is coordinator of the American Civil Liberties Union's Racial Profiling Task Force. He says the government's reasoning doesn't hold water. He points to a recent report from the Office of the Investigator General showing that none of the hundreds of post-9/11 detentions of Arab immigrants have led to any arrests of terror suspects. The ACLU's Downing says a bill sponsored by Senator Russ Feingold and Congressman John Conyers goes much further to combat racial stereotyping.
That bill also does what this guideline does, which is ban racial profiling, but it also has some teeth. So there is a dog in the yard, and the dog has some bite in addition to bark. And that bans racial profiling. It requires all federal and local law enforcement agencies to collect data on who they stop and search, because that has been the key part of the community's ability to document what they have known was going on all along. It also allows a private cause of action where there is an allegation of racial profiling, and most importantly, it allows for the withholding of federal funding to agencies that carry out the practice.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle.
Leaders from South Korea, Japan, and the United States met in Hawaii last weekend to discuss the Korean Peninsula roadmap. The three nations agreed to crack down on what they say is Pyongyang's trade in illegal drugs and counterfeit money, and demanded that North Korea abandon its nuclear program. Meanwhile, civic groups from both North and South Korea, along with an international delegation, held celebrations to commemorate the June 15, 2000 summit between former South Korean President Kim Jae-hyung and North Korean President Kim Jong-il. Simba Rousseau files this report from the border of North and South Korea.
The ongoing investigation into the allegation that Hyundai Business Group, in collaboration with former President Kim Dae-jung, gave money to North Korea in exchange for realizing the summit meeting, has dampened this year's celebrations. But last week, the reconnection of cross-border railways proved that North and South Korea will continue to seek reconciliation. This was one of the key projects agreed after the historic summit 3 years ago. To commemorate the event, civic groups from both North and South Korea held rallies simultaneously on the border in support of reunification. Georgia University professor Han Park explains how the nuclear crisis came about.
Mr. George W. Bush came in and he very quickly suspended all policies toward North Korea. North Korean military capability is very formidable. I believe they have nuclear bombs and they have the ability to produce more bombs. As a country that is poor, really struggling with shortages of food, and still developed that level in military preparedness. In fact, North Korea ranks fourth in the entire world in terms of military personnel and believed to be military preparedness. North Korea is no Afghanistan, North Korea is no Iraq.
On Monday, nearly 12,000 Japanese citizens viewed a display of the Choryo 3705. This North Korean vessel was salvaged from the East China Sea in 2001 after a gun battle with a Japanese Coast Guard. Japanese Prime Minister Koizumi in mid-May pushed legislation through that gave Japanese military forces more freedom to respond to attacks as a result of North Korea's nuclear ambitions. In contrast, a member of the international delegation drew parallels from the India-Pakistan issue and the race for nuclear weapons to ensure security.
50 years ago, people share the same heritage, same cultural leanings. We eat the same food, we enjoy the same songs, and yet we became two separate countries. And I have been at the border of India and Pakistan also, hoping that one day those borders will be opened up.
Hari Sharma, a professor emeritus of sociology at Simon Fraser University in Canada, discusses who actually is a threat, not only to East Asia, but to the rest of the world.
It's not North Korea which is a threat. The threat is coming from the United States. South Korea, reliable outpost of the worldwide hegemonic designs of the U.S. government, as was Japan, or as has been Japan, as has been Israel, as was Iraq at one time. After all, who trained Saddam Hussein?
After the Bush No Summit last month, South Korea announced that it would increase its 2004 budget to include 8.1 trillion won for the long-term acquisition of new equipment such as missiles, surveillance planes, and military satellites, and that U.S. troops would be moved away from the border and replaced with South Korean soldiers. This comes after U.S. Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz urged South Korea to increase military spending in line with U.S. plans to spend $11 billion in the next 3 years on weapons modernization and systems upgrades for its forces in South Korea. Nevertheless, President No seems to be making clear efforts to rekindle relations through trade, which has risen from $400 million to $640 million. But organizers of the rally say that Bush is the deciding factor of a possible second Korean War, and they will continue to organize civic groups from the two Koreas. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Simba Rousseau in the Demilitarized Zone, Korea.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Amabwadi.